in one form or another. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, and civil affairs. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian, get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, including articles I've written, the most weekly Govorit Moskva press briefing, and other bonus content like the Chronicles of a Different Russia Alternative Histories. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Before I start, let me just briefly mention that on Tuesday evening I will be speaking at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies of University College London as part of the event to relaunch Slova, the student-run academic journal, which a long, long, long time ago I was one of the co-editors. I'll leave a link in the programme notes if you're going to be around and you want to come. I imagine the Masaryk room in which we'll be held has air conditioning. I can certainly hope so. Anyway, so maybe see you Tuesday evening. So, as I said, I wanted to talk about three books, a trio, all written by journalists, and all truly, in my opinion, first rate. Now, I should just mention a little point about my philosophy of book reviews. On the whole, I'm not going to be bothering to cover books that I think are either bad or okay. I think it seems a waste of my time and a waste of yours. I will occasionally, very occasionally, cover books that I think are bad, either because they have some aspect of them that I think is particularly interesting or relevant, or precisely because I really, really want to push back against some aspect of their central theme. Generally speaking, though, I'm only going to bring to your attention books that I think are good. So it's not that I think that all books are good. It's just that the other ones I don't waste your time with. Anyway, so three books. I know it's always a bit of a cliche to they say these kind of books, you know, read like spy thrillers. But in this case, in different ways, they all do, and I think all benefit in the process. Anyway, the three books are Sean Walker's The Illegals, Russia's Most Audacious Spies and the Plot to Infiltrate the West, from Profile Books in 2025. Drew Hinshaw and Joe Parkinson's Swap, A Secret History of the New Cold War, HarperCollins, 2025, and Bojan Panchevsky's The Nord Stream Conspiracy, Hutchinson, 2026. So let's start with Sean Walker's book. Now, you know, I imagine that many of my listeners are going to know who Sean Walker is, long-time Russia correspondent for The Guardian. Now there's an East Europe person, very good journalist, and we actually have a shared experience of the two of us were on the first Russian stop list of people indefinitely barred back in, or of Brits rather, back in June of 2022. And the surreal thing was that Sean and I were about the only people on that list who actually ever really travelled to Russia. Now, I will confess that in the main, I tend to have a slight prejudice against the sort of books that journalists, and particularly journalists, they go to Russia. And it's almost that sense of, well, if you've been a Russia correspondent, well, then when you leave, it's time to write your book. And these books tend to be often very readable, but more than a little bit routine. You know, usual cast of characters, the quietly resolute dissident, the chain-smoking artsy types, the cheerfully cynical government hacks. And, well, look, you know the drill. They do have a tendency to sort of, if AI could actually write like a human being, what you might get. The exceptions, though, do tend to be exceptional, and this is one such. Walker starts with the 2010 Illegals case. You remember that? All those Russian deep cover agents who were sort of rounded up, with one exception, the exception being the one of them who actually probably did any real good. I mean, this was an extraordinary case in which the Russians spent a huge amount of resource building up the cover identities, the so-called legends, for these people, implanting them, and probably learnt very little other than perhaps the best place to get a latte in downtown DC. The point is then, from that, Walker broadens it out to sort of a wider history of Russian illegals, Again, so these are specifically those kind of, you know, the Americans style, the TV series, sort of deep cover agents on the basis of, you know, loads and loads of interviews and archival material and the like. And one of the things that interested me was precisely why Russia historically, because it's not just under you know, post-Soviet Russia, it's very much a feature of the old Soviet system, why they're so enamored of illegals. In that this is something that is incredibly expensive, because you do have to train these people so that they can plausibly present themselves as being totally different people from totally different countries, speaking languages fluently and the like, understanding all those the unspoken little sort of national idioms and quirks and characteristics. It's incredibly complex. And it is so often so deeply ineffective. And in many ways, I would suggest, this is just my take, is that this is a kind of a metaphor for a lot of intelligence gathering. Most intelligence that is gathered is no big deal. Is just the same as you would get from open source reporting. And look, I mean, I know this just, again, going back to my own very brief experience back in the 1990s when I was a consumer of classified material in my time at the Foreign Office. Most of it, you think, yeah, I knew that. The point is not the 95% that is banal. The point is the 5% or whatever the percentage, even if it's 1%, which actually may well be truly pivotal. That really does change your perspective, or that absolutely confirms your hunch. Because often the value of intelligence is not that it tells you something you really didn't have any idea about. It's that you had a sense that something was happening, but it was just a sense. And sure, you could assemble some open source in support, but you could also just as easily assemble open source questioning it. But that then this gives you some greater degree of confidence in the outcome. So, in some ways, one has to accept that most intelligence gathering is doomed to be pointless. But that's the necessary price for those nuggets of gold that you'll get amidst all the gravel. And in particular, you know, it certainly made sense for the early Bolshevik state to be so obsessed with these illegals. Because remember, most intelligence officers abroad, not agents, officers, they are operating under diplomatic cover. Yeah, they're the classic, I mean, the old cliche, the sort of second cultural attaché or the defence attaché or whatever, who actually, as their second job, are off recruiting and running human intelligence sources. But the point is, the Bolshevik state didn't have diplomatic relations with most Western countries. So, you know, again, it had to use alternative ways of recruiting and moving agents into these Western countries that they regarded very much and, frankly, much more credibly than now as a genuine malign threat. And likewise, perhaps in the height of the Cold War, one could argue that their diplomatic, you know, officers under diplomatic cover were much, much more sort of carefully monitored. And it also reflects a state that historically has been more willing to take risks. It's a lovely little anecdote about in 1936, the British ambassador in Moscow refused permission to have an MI6 station operating in the embassy because their presence might, quote, cause embarrassment, unquote. Well, Moscow very rarely worries too much about embarrassment. So anyway, it's a story of the illegals, lots, you know, fascinating cast of individuals. I particularly love the story of, again, this is going back to the interwar period, Dmitry Bystrolyotov, who had been a seafarer, a gravedigger, and a law student. I mean, how's that for a resume? Before being recruited, and then took on a whole series of false covers. So there was the Hungarian count fallen on hard times, Canadian timber merchant, a Greek businessman, Dutch artist, a British aristocrat. And in particular, I mean, he groomed as a source a disaffected British Foreign Office staffer, an alcoholic by the name of Ernest Oldham, who then would become, and this is a real intelligence coup, a cipher clerk. In other words, had access to the coding. Anyway, so lots and lots of nice vignettes. Very good also on the use of illegals monitoring Czechoslovakia before and after the 1968 Prague Spring was crushed. Got to remember that intelligence activities that don't always take place are on what you might think of as the outside world. And also a nice little tale of a young Sergei Ivanov, remember, who's just died, who'd been posted to Helsinki in the 80s, striking up a friendship with his US opposite number, and apparently, sort of a very cordial relationship. They went for dinner at each other's and so forth. But it later transpired that once when he was at dinner, he had sprayed the American with this odourless, colourless dust with a special chemical marker, so that later the Soviets could check the clothes and belongings of their diplomats, and if any of them showed traces of this dust, they knew they'd have a potential traitor. I mean, such is the paranoia of intelligence life. And also, little note, actually, I should mention that there's a case about Yuri Andropov, while he was head of the KGB, meeting the legendary agent runner Yuri Drozdov, whom he would then go on to appoint as head of Directorate S, which ran the illegals program, over lemon tea. Well, as long-time listeners will know, as my view is clearly that it is indeed, as I sip it right now while we're talking, that is the true beverage of distinction. But of course, the real big question is whether or not in an era of biometric identities, of Bellingcat and other open source analysts, and indeed of social media, illegals have any place yet. And honestly, I'm not so sure, although the point is made at the end of the book that it only takes just one of these illegals to pull off a sort of a genuine intelligence coup to justify the whole program, which, again, going back to the 5% versus 95% argument. And indeed, as Hinshaw and Parkinson note in the book that I'll come to next, you know, it was illegals who pulled off some of the greatest intelligence coups of the 20th century, from infiltrating the Manhattan Project to recruiting the Cambridge Five. But the thing is that, you know, one of its real values of this whole program is precisely what it does about getting inside the heads of its enemies, of the degree to which Western counterintelligence services are going to see, if not reds, red, white and blues, under every bed, and actually end up counterproductively sort of hunting traitors within their own ranks. I mean, that's also a valuable effect, because there's nothing more disruptive to an intelligence service than a mole hunt. But what does it say maybe about power in Moscow, though? Well, again, I think that it actually speaks to the whole notion of conceptual dominance, because there's also a particular value in claiming that you have information that is coming from an insider. It's one thing to say, this is what our, you know, telecommunications intercepts suggest, or this is what our analysts believe. But to be able to go to a political leader and say, we have a guy on the inside who can tell us this as a fact, that has a lot of power. And I think, again, one of the things that drives intelligence services is, after all, not just gathering intelligence, but relevance. They have to be able to brief. They have to be able to actually convince the policymakers of their significance and their accuracy. And this is a powerful asset in that respect for them. Now, moving on, Hinshaw and Parkinson and their book Swap, I mean, they're both Wall Street Journal veteran journalists, and so it's not at all surprising that the heart of this book is the case of Evan Gershkovich, who was the Wall Street Journal's Moscow correspondent, was arrested in Yekaterinburg in 2023, charged by the FSB with acting on behalf of foreign intelligence and attempting to collect classified information about Uralvagonzavod, which is one of the biggest tank makers in Russia. And, well, there was no surprise that he was going to be convicted. He was indeed duly convicted in June 2024, because, let's face it, the FSB doesn't lose cases in Russian courts. And he was sentenced to 16 years in prison. And therefore, despite the admittedly slightly overbroad subtitle, remember the book is called Swap, A Secret History of the New Cold War, it's first and foremost about the whole process that led up to the massive 26-person prisoner exchange in Turkey that saw Gershkovich released in August 2024, the largest prisoner exchange in post-Cold War history. And it uses this to spin off and talk about some of the, you know, wider dynamics of Western cooperation, collaboration and confrontation with Russia, how nonetheless contacts could be made and a deal struck. And, you know, it's worth noting, after all, that essentially most of the people whom the West got back were poor bastards who were caught in the firing line when the Russians were just simply assembling commodities to bargain with. Whereas what the Russians got were a collection of spies, money launderers and cyber criminals. Especially, I think the one person they really wanted to get back was Vadim Krasikov, who was a Russian contract killer who'd then been recruited by the FSB, given a rank within their Vimpel Special Operations Unit, and who had been used to go and kill Zelimkhan Kangoshvili, a Chechen, very virulently anti-Moscow Chechen, who had fought against the Russians in both Chechnya and Georgia and was passing information on to the Western intelligence services. Anyway, he was gunned down in Berlin by Krasikov, and the Russians really wanted him back. Now, Hinshaw and Parkinson are very much right, I mean, they say it themselves, in the narrative non-fiction style. So it's, you know, it's very much gives all the background stuff of the pencils on the desk and such like. And I will confess, this is just a pedant within me. Sometimes I wonder how far they are embroidering a little bit too much on precisely what they know. I mean, the one that, for whatever reason, just stood out for me was the little details that when FSB's Major General Vladislav Minshikov is briefing Putin over a secure video call, and they say he was unsmiling. Now, he probably didn't exactly crack a broad grin while he's chatting to the dictator president of his country. But I'm thinking, well, unless you really got to see that, how do you know he was unsmiling? A trivial point. It makes for a very good read. But as I say, the pedant in me occasionally does keep missing a beat for this kind of storytelling. However, I absolutely am not challenging in any way the information that's being presented. And it is undeniably vivid. I mean, they have a great, for example, cameo of Pablo González, the Basque-Spanish journalist who had, incidentally, a Darth Vader tattoo on his leg. Lovely little detail. But he was a fixture of reporting from the Maidan in 2014 and then Crimea. And, you know, again, his access seemed extraordinary. Well, perhaps not quite so extraordinary when you realise that he was actually born Pavel Rubtsov and was a deep cover GRU illegal operating under the guise of a Spanish journalist. So lots of nice things. And the other weird thing, actually, is also that, ironically, they have less of the sort of personal insights of their newspaper colleague, Gershkovich himself. But then again, he does have his own memoir, This Cursed Beautiful Land, coming out later this year. So maybe he was saving the goodies for that. Still, where this book really shines is in unpacking the complex, fraught, morally challenging negotiations behind this swap, which, as I say, was clearly a ruthless Russian operation to collect enough Americans and other swappable commodities from ex-US Marine Paul Whelan through to dissidents like Karamurza, Vladimir Karamurza, and Ilya Yashin, until they had reached a sufficient critical mass, really, that the White House was ready to deal. And it's clearly a sign, I would say, that hostage diplomacy is here to stay. And it's also, indeed, a reminder of the whole process of what the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime is calling geocrime. In other words, the instrumental use of organized crime as a tool of statecraft. I mean, Krasikov mattered. He had to be brought home because it was part of the social contract that, frankly, went back to KGB days, is that, you know, if you're one of ours and you get caught abroad, we will get you home eventually. It might take a week, it might take a month, it might take a decade, but one way we will get you back, which is an incentive for people to keep their mouths shut when they get caught. But also it's an incentive for people to actually do dangerous things. They need to get Krasikov back, in my opinion, because they wanted there to be more Krasikovs in the future. And that's something that we will actually have to deal with. Now, again, what does this say? What does this Gexel book say about power in Moscow? Well, there was a nice little note that when Maria Butina, if you remember, this Russian-American who, you know, could hardly be described as a sort of covert source. I mean, she's very openly a sort of essentially a political activist, very close to various right-wing Russian, American institutions like the NRA, and very much pushing a line about how, frankly, America should be doing deals with the Russians and so forth. When she was arrested, she faced perhaps 5 years in prison. But according to Hinshaw and Parkinson, Putin was briefed that actually it was 15 years that she faced. Now, was that an honest mistake, I wonder? Or was it a bid to outrage the boss into demanding some kind of retaliation and a swap? So in other words, we know, was this a manipulative operation? And also, the book very much highlights the way that intelligence officers, intelligence services are used as a back channel, even in very difficult times. And we've seen this in other cases, like, you know, Mossad talking to the Arabs back in the day when the Arab nations weren't even recognizing the existence of Israel. So, for example, we saw Nikolai Patrushev and his counterpart Sullivan being used as sort of contact points. And in particular, Sergei Beseda, so-called known as the Count, who was at that time head of the FSB's Fifth Service. And he was being used as very much the sort of point negotiator on these swaps. But he would only, he wasn't willing to talk to diplomats because he didn't think they mattered. He was only willing to talk to counterpart intelligence officers with whom he would be very genial and such like. And maybe in this respect, there is a kind of a degree of transactional power. Not so much between the Russian and American intelligence community, though obviously once you sit down to make a deal, you do feel a certain shared imperative to make that deal when your political leaderships want it to happen. But rather the degree to which you had Beseda negotiating, but negotiating also for agents who are associated with GRU and SVR, not just FSB. So in some ways, he was actually doing them a favour, and no doubt at some point, this is a bargaining chip that could be redeemed for the FSB's advantage. And finally, we have Panchevsky, also of the Wall Street Journal, writing on what is very timely in a week that the German authorities have charged a Ukrainian with responsibility for the 2022 bombing of the $20 billion Nord Stream gas pipelines. And doing so as part of a Ukrainian government-backed mission. I mean, that's a crucial thing. And this is really an amazing inside story. It takes the reader not just into the plot, but also the, and I hadn't realised much of the detail here, the very dogged German investigation that is only now bearing fruit. And it's fascinating the degree to which they operated within a very Germanic system of all kinds of limits and constraints, but nonetheless, they kept at it. And yes, so this investigation is now bearing fruit. Many of the prime movers in this book are described and discussed, but still shrouded behind pseudonyms. So you have all these sort of picturesque, you know, the colonel, the grandpa, the respectable. And look, it's a great read. So the prose is a little journalistically fragmented into lots and lots and lots of short paragraphs. But still, great read. I devoured it in terrifyingly little time, but also very, very solidly sourced. I can't recommend this book too highly. And it's a very useful reminder that at the time, there were those who, however implausibly, were blaming Russia for blowing up its own pipeline, or the CIA, or the Scandinavians, or Poland, or whatever. It always seemed that Kyiv had the most to gain. And, well, indeed, it turned out that it was Kyiv that did it. But still, this is a very, very Ukrainian story, in that it really stems not from policies decided at the top, but a bottom-up initiative, what Panchevsky calls the start-up, funded, by figures like this, a businessman called the Walking Lawsuit. Not, indeed, it's worth noting, former President Poroshenko, though he did try and cash in on the popularity of the incident later. But anyway, so you have this kind of startup that operates, you know, to a degree under a kind of latitude that only then is brought into official service, but still with considerable autonomy, operating with extraordinary flair and a willingness to take risks that US Navy SEALs or British Special Boat Service divers would never consider. It's one of the reasons why people are saying, oh, it has to have been something else. Can't just simply been some guys operating off a rented yacht. But also, it's a reminder that these are people willing to carry out sabotage against what is a German economic asset, by which I don't mean that the Germans owned the Nord Stream pipelines. I mean, Nord Stream 1 is 51% owned by the Russians. and Nord Stream 2 entirely owned by Gazprom. But the point is, it provided gas to Germany. So yeah, it's a useful reminder in that case that nations have their own interests, even while they maybe ostensibly working together. You know, Ukraine's interests are not exactly those of the West, and vice versa. Panchevsky closes by saying, "It had an effect that its authors never really contemplated. It crossed a red line in modern conflict. Critical infrastructure, once considered off-limits, became fair game. It created a world of shadow warfare where pipelines, deep-sea cables, tankers or satellites can be struck with relative impunity, introducing a new and deeply unsettling uncertainty into the global order. Where Western capitals sometimes suffer paralysis by analysis, the hive mind in Kyiv acts first and argues later." So, again, that is worth noting, because this is indeed the new environment in which we operate, in which all of these ancillary support infrastructures of the modern economy have been sucked into the covert political struggle. There's also, I should also mention, there's a lovely line. "Ukraine's intelligence officers, once they achieve a certain rank, are a small community. Their relationships generally range from hating to despising one another. At some point, they all will have rubbed one another the wrong way, caught one another stealing, or wronged one another somehow. They are not shy about slandering each other." Now, I mentioned that because just it's interesting that, you know, despite, as we know, how extraordinarily effective the Ukrainian intelligence community is, this is something that I had heard from other sources, but I'd heard from other sources that were, I think it's fair to say, distinctly critical of the Ukrainians. So it's quite interesting to find someone who, you know, while retaining journalistic neutrality, you know, clearly does have a lot of sympathy for the Ukrainian perspective, also adding that. And generally speaking, look, this book confirms that while Western intelligence agencies were not behind this attack, the CIA, Dutch military intelligence, the MIVD, and others were aware of the plan beforehand and explicitly warned Kyiv to abort the mission weeks before the actual attack. And yet Kyiv ignored them. And then the Western agencies cooperated in covering up Kyiv's involvement. I mean, just remember that when next you see some newspaper story citing unnamed Western intelligence sources. Of course, they lie to us. Sure, they do so convinced it is for the greater good, but they lie to us. Conceptual dominance happens in all kinds of contexts. But finally, the whole book is also a useful reminder when we pivot back to looking at Russia. Never to presume that institutions are other than collections of sometimes collaborating, often feuding individuals and interests, that they may well share certain collective interests and worldviews. But in practice, this often takes second place to self-interest. But of course, that self-interest can become a collective one. You know, we have seen far greater cooperation between the SVR, the FSB and the GRU than we ever saw before 2022, when they were engaged in a often cannibalistic struggle for remits, responsibilities, budgets, access to Putin, generally his favour. Now, in part, this is understood as because being the Kremlin has put out the word that it expects everyone to play nice with each other. But it is more than that. It is the fact that these agencies all regard themselves as now being in a common struggle. It is obviously much, much less powerful a force than for the Ukrainians. But nonetheless, again, when it comes down to it, these are constellations of individuals and interest groups. And power itself is a deeply fractured and contested factor. So, am I arguing anything more than just simply, hey, the world is a complicated place? Well, I am trying to do so a little bit more. I'm trying to bring a certain degree of framework onto it. But yes, when it comes down to it, what I am saying is, the world is a complex place, and Putin's system perhaps even more so. But, well, for me, that's part of the fun. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti, or Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.
I wanna go somewhere. side, on the other 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 side.
Bad line.
Yo, bad line.
Bad line.
Ebo, ebo.
Bad line.
Make baby, we do this. Take it to them.
Oh na, ich bin Kunsthänger ab im MoMA. Tota, Player chill auf deinem Sofa. Global, egal ob Agra oder Roma. Sie feiern meinen Flow up, social. Gestockt von einer Cruda. Call me, call me. Motorola, pumps mein Sound im Toyota. Lass dich wackeln wie ein Nokia. Bringe dich zum Schwitzen. Hitze, West Samoa.
Support your local, MC, support your local.
Record Store, man, I'm on game over. Bin wie Mentos in der Cola, all die MCs fallen ins Koma. Heavy Metal Yoga, Hände hoch, Ayoba. Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich
Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich
Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich
Badland, 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 Badland. Bin Fresh seit 1990, Rap seitdem ich 9 bin. Flashe deine Freunde mit Tracks, die immer neu klingen. Relax mit meinen Leuten, mach Cash in meinen Träumen. Wenn Rechte sich aus Neuen, krieg ich Text von ihren Bräuten. Bin die eine, die keine hegen kann. Wenn ich Reime, fangen deine Beine das B-Mann. Was für ein Leben, Mann, bange nicht, gehört zu PKK. Nicht leicht mit der Herkunft, bin den langen Weg gegangen. Von Oriental Dollars zu Wikipedia. Eure Masterarbeit fängt mir als These an. Wenn es jemals ein Genie in der Szene gab, ist das E zum B, O zum W, Badland. Badland, 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 Badland,
sie nennen mich.
Badland, 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 Badland,
sie nennen mich.
Badland, 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 Badland,
sie nennen mich.
Badland, 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 Badland.
Mini Mies, Mini, 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 Mini Mies. Wollen sein wie ich. Tut mir leid, ich bin ein Unikat. Ihr seid so, ich bin so. Du bist das Duplikat von einem Duplikat. Ich bin und bleib ein Chock, super, Superstar. Bad to the land, das Girl, das plötzlich kam. Changed euren Plan, legte alles lahm. Wenn ich komme, dann steht die Stadt still. Von Berlin bis hin nach Basel. Von den Straßen bis hin in die letzten Etagen. Kennen Sie meinen Namen?
Calabadland and she knows it. Fire up on its own explosions. Badland and she knows it. Fire up on its own explosions. Come again.
Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich.
Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich.
Badland, 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 Badland.
Sie nennen mich.
Badland, Badland, Badland. Badland, Badland.
Bop, 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 bop